Welcome to Leonard Lopate Weekend, where we bring you three of our favorite segments from the last week in case you missed them. You can find all of our segments on the WNYC app, our website at WNYC.org, or on iTunes. Just search for Leonard Lopate. And of course, you can also listen to us live on the radio every weekday starting at noon.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi declared a caliphate across Iraq and Syria, the Islamic State, in June 2014 in Mosul, Iraq. According to U.S. military officials, ISIS has lost at least 50,000 fighters in the last 2 years since then, and it has also lost much of the territory it once held. Are extremist and terrorist jihadi movements in general losing ground? In After the Islamic State, Where Will Jihadis Take the War?, New Yorker staff writer Robin Wright looks at how extremist and terrorist movements are evolving in the Middle East. And you can find a link to it on the Leonard Lopate show page at WNYC.org. I'm pleased that it brings Robin Wright back to our show. Welcome back.
It's great to be with you always, Leonard. Thanks for having me.
Islamic State militants have retaken the ancient Syrian city of Palmyra. Were U.S. or other Western military officials surprised?
Yes, and I think the Syrians were very surprised. As the Syrians were focused on retaking Aleppo in the north, ISIS moved its forces into the central desert and took a city that they had lost about 9 months ago. So this is, for them, a real coup at a time that they're under extraordinary pressure across the caliphate. Over the last year, they have lost more than 50% of the territory that ISIS fighters captured in northern Iraq, and almost a third of the territory they have lost in Syria. So this is, in many ways, retaking turf, but it doesn't mean that they're not in trouble. They're still under extraordinary pressure, but the bottom line is they are going to continue to morph and evolve and adapt to the realities on the ground.
They lost the Syrian city of Raqqa, which they had declared to be their capital. That must have been an embarrassment. And isn't there an offensive now to reclaim the northern Iraqi city of Mosul? That's been underway since October. How's it progressing?
Well, they haven't taken, ISIS has not lost Raqqa. There are two huge pieces of property that their prime property in this so-called caliphate. And one, as you point out, is Mosul in Iraq, which is Iraq's second largest city and the largest of any city held by ISIS. The second is Raqqa, which is in northeast Syria and its so-called capital. And both initiatives started the offensive against ISIS in Mosul in October and in November against Raqqa. They are being waged by very different forces. There are an array of Iraqi military, official military and militias squeezing Mosul now. They've captured a good bit of part of the city. There has been a move on Raqqa, but it has taken territory around or near Raqqa, but not Raqqa yet. These are likely to play out over the next few months. And the big question becomes, of course, what then does ISIS do to keep the idea of its caliphate alive, even if it doesn't have the territory that it needs to actually govern?
And what's going to happen to the enormous refugee population?
Well, Leonard, that, of course, is this the biggest humanitarian crisis anywhere in the world since World War II, and it plays out in all the different wars that have been produced by ISIS, by the Syrian government, the different layers of conflict in this part of what was already the world's most volatile region. And the refugees have fled in unprecedented numbers. Almost 5 million now from Syria, large numbers of displaced people inside Iraq and some who've crossed the border. And, you know, the problem is that even if we had peace tomorrow, which seems incredibly unlikely anytime soon, the problem is there has been so much vast destruction that there aren't, whether it's the homes, the businesses, the schools, the hospitals, to reabsorb people in what in anything close to a semblance of normal life.
And now we're hearing horrible stories from Aleppo.
Yes. And the fall of Aleppo, which seems imminent, the Syrian army in a kind of crescendo of airstrikes has, after 6 years of war around Aleppo, has finally taken close to 98-99% of eastern Aleppo, where the rebels had held out. And of course, Aleppo is the largest city in Syria, and this has produced, you know, not just waves of new refugees, new displaced people, but it's also led to reports by UN officials, by local observers, by journalists who are based there, of atrocities, you know, summary executions of men leaving the eastern Aleppo, missing people believed to be detained or imprisoned by the regime, and purported atrocities against women and children, too. There are frantic calls by human rights groups for the international community to do something to stop the flow of bloodshed around this ancient biblical city.
And many years ago, on one of our food segments on this show, we talked about the rich food culture of Aleppo. That's before all of this happened. We don't even think about Aleppo in those terms anymore.
And we don't realize, in modern terms, how important this city was in human history. It goes back 5,000 years. Abraham is said to have grazed his sheep on its slopes and had donated their milk to the local poor. You know, Alexander the Great created an important settlement in Aleppo. It's mentioned in the Old Testament, the Book of Samuel and the Psalms. And Shakespeare even mentions Aleppo in both Macbeth and Othello. So this is a city that has played an important role in human history, and its destruction is a loss not just for Syrians and not just for people in the Middle East, but for the rest of us, too.
I'm speaking to Robin Wright, whose article, After the Islamic State, Where Will the Jihadis Take the War?, was in The New Yorker recently. Later we'll also talk about her most recent article, Having Tea with Hezbollah's Number 2. What areas have you seen, Percy?
Personally?
Yes.
Well, I've spent the last 2 years, I've been covering the Middle East since 1973. I've covered every war, every uprising, protest, revolution since the 1973 war. But the last 2 years, I've spent a lot of time going on the borders of what is ISIS. It's the first war I haven't been able to report from inside the war. It's simply too dangerous for journalists who've been beheaded and imprisoned by the fanatics. But I spent a lot of time, for example, in Iraq this spring on the front line with Mosul. I went down with the Kurdish fighters who are now trying to win it back. I spent a lot of time during the Battle of Kobani on the Syrian border with Turkey, wandering that whole border, watching as American airstrikes, you know, drop their bombs literally several yards from where I was standing, interviewing refugees who'd fled the scene, watching them cross that border. And most recently, I've been in Lebanon along the Syrian border, where ISIS and the Al-Qaeda franchise called the Nusra Front have been penetrating. There are anywhere from 1,000 to 2,000 fighters there now who are also destabilizing Little Lebanon.
Are any American troops operating on the ground?
Yes, and that's really an about-face after the U.S. withdrawal in 2011. There are today close to 5,000 U.S. forces in Iraq. They are not fighting. They're not in a combat role, but they are advising and assisting and in some ways kind of orchestrating the offensive against Mosul, and that's an important role. In Syria, we have several thousand special forces who've been advising rebels in the same kind of role, train or advise and assist. And, of course, the most important role the United States is playing is its air power, that every single day there are American warplanes pounding ISIS positions in both Iraq and Syria to the tune of $12.5 million a day. And that has been, I think, the single biggest factor in the deaths of, as you mentioned, 50,000 ISIS fighters over the last 2 years.
So how well trained or equipped are the Iraqi forces? And what about the various groups fighting in Syria? First of all, those groups in Syria, can we talk about them a bit more? Should we call them jihadis as well?
The problem in Syria is that you have literally hundreds of different forces fighting on the ground among the rebels, and they don't all agree. You'll find some who are non-ideological. They're just trying to preserve their homelands, protect their neighborhoods. Then there are others who are nationalist in their agenda. They want a role in governing the state. There are some who are deeply ideological, some who are Islamist, some who are members of the largest al-Qaeda franchise. Of all the al-Qaeda branches around the world in Syria. And so it's hard to stereotype or put them all in the same category. Some of them are fairly well-armed, but clearly not capable. They don't have tanks. They have no air power. They have no long-range artillery, or at least comparable to what the Syrian government has. So they are outmanned and outgunned by the Syrian military, especially with all the foreign forces the Syrian government has, from the Russian military advisor, the Iranians, who are there by the thousands, and Hezbollah. And Hezbollah has anywhere from 5,000 to 8,000 forces there. So the Syrian government has a lot of props. The Syrian rebels, the various factions, are not well-trained. They were motivated initially in part by what started as a peaceful uprising and then disintegrated when President Assad took up arms and used force against his own people, disintegrated into a civil war. And so these were rebels who were not well prepared for all-out war. They were in some ways destined to lose Aleppo because they just couldn't withstand the air power used by the Syrians. And, of course, the United States, in its role, the U.S. runs a coalition of more than 60 countries involved in the war against ISIS. The U.S. has not wanted to use its air power on behalf of the rebels. The U.S. role has been simply on one part of the Syrian conflict. And there are many wars playing out in Syria, which is what makes it the most complicated conflict anywhere in the world. There's the ISIS war, then there's the rebel war with the central government. There's the kind of proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Then there's the big power war or conflict or tensions, rivalry between the United States and Russia. And then, of course, there's the sectarian dimension, the Sunni versus the Shiite. So, and you find all of those factors playing out among the rebels, who they side with, who supports them, who arms and funds them. So it's not a simple question. And, you know, the prospects of the rebels actually ever winning is probably pretty minimal. But the next focus after Aleppo is going to be a province called Idlib, and that's where they are much stronger. That's where the Syrian government can't surround them as they did in Aleppo, because part of Idlib borders Turkey, and the Turks have not supported the government in Damascus. So that's the Syrian picture.
Although the Turks, what's complicated that is that the best fighters against Bashar al-Assad seem to be Kurds, and Turkey does not want to support the Kurds. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights has warned of war crimes in Aleppo and has accused all parties in Syria of violating international laws. So is the U.S. aiding and abetting war crimes?
Oh, clearly there is going to be an enormous backlash, or that this conflict, the aftermath of this, is going to play out for a long time because of these allegations of atrocities. There are charges today as well that the rebels did not want people to, or blocked in some cases, people from leaving East Aleppo and going to the government-controlled areas in Western Aleppo. That's not true of all the rebels. It's some rebel groups. Again, it's a complicated picture, but that's clearly a concern that there are, you know, very few good guys in this conflict.
We'll take a little break and come back with more from Robin Wright, whose article after the Islamic State, Where Will Jihadis Take the Wars, in The New Yorker. And you can find a link to it on our show page at wnyc.org/Lopate. Stay with us for more. We're talking with Robin Wright, her article after the Islamic State, Where Will Jihadis Take the Wars, in The New Yorker. And you can find a link to it on our show page at wnyc.org/Lopate. President Obama repeatedly demanded that Bashar al-Assad leave office. Does he continue to hold that position?
I think the United States very much wants Assad to leave, but the diplomatic focus over the last few months has really been on finding a means for a political transition that will include both President Assad and the opposition. The Russians have made this impossible now. They've balked at even finding a means for a ceasefire that will allow people to leave, not just leave eastern Aleppo, but go to a place where they feel safe. And that's been a deep frustration to the United States. But it's now clear that Assad comes out as a much stronger player, having his forces retake Aleppo. This was effectively the New York of Syria, the largest commercial hub, psychologically one of the really important cities in the Middle East. And retaking it will give him some new momentum, some standing, and will make it appear that he's likely to hang around for at least the short-term future.
Now, why would the Obama administration think that regime change would work any better in Syria than it did in Iraq or Libya or anywhere else that we have tried it?
Well, remember that the Syrian war began as part of the Arab Spring in 2011, when the regimes in Tunisia, Libya, Egypt, and Yemen were all ousted. And there was a sense that Syria was next. You saw a group of teenagers, post 13 and 14-year-olds, posting anti-government graffiti on walls, and their arrests led, in a remote southern town, led to protests that then swept the country. And it looked like, as millions turned out on streets across the country, that Assad was in trouble and was also next. And there were a lot of bets in Washington. People took pools on, will it be 2 weeks or 2 months? But no one thought that he could endure. But in large part because he saw that the militaries caved in other countries and didn't want to open fire on their own people, he quickly used his most loyal forces to try to quash the uprising. And again, no one thought he could survive that long term. There were initially some defections. The rebels began to mobilize. The outside world began to help the rebels. And it disintegrated into a civil war. And of course, with so much outside assistance, particularly the air power provided by the Russians, he has gradually retaken control of many of the major cities in his country that he had initially lost.
What have Donald Trump or any of his likely cabinet members had to say about the fight against ISIS in Iraq and Syria, or about the regime of Bashar al-Assad?
Well, it's very interesting. It's, of course, very hard to tell what the president-elect is actually going to do, because he's been a little bit all over the map on his positions on these key conflicts.
Didn't he say he had a secret plan to defeat ISIS during one of the debates?
He did indeed, and then wouldn't give specifics because he said it was secret, and that one of the big mistakes the United States or the Obama administration had made was announcing when they were going to leave Iraq. He also has said he's going to be much tougher on ISIS. I mean, one of the problems is it's harder to be tougher on ISIS because we have to be able to identify where the ISIS fighters are, and they have so effectively penetrated civilian communities that there's a danger of a lot more civilian deaths. But the fact is that the air campaign has been incredibly successful, if you think about it. ISIS losing 50,000 fighters, it has about 20,000 fighters today. There's been a huge drop in the number of foreign fighters. And just in the last week, the United States hit in one day 168 oil tankers that ISIS used to export oil and provide it millions of dollars of income. But at the same time, the president-elect has talked about seeing Syria differently than a lot of people and the officials in the current administration or even in the Western alliance have. And he's kind of hinted that he may be willing to do a deal with the Russians on Syria. And this would effectively or could effectively be a boost for President Assad as well. His family has now ruled Syria for 46 years since a coup by his father in 1970.
Trump will nominate Exxon, in fact, is nominating ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson to be Secretary of State. And we've heard a lot about ExxonMobil's connections to Russia and Tillerson's friendship with Vladimir Putin. Wouldn't that also suggest a change in U.S. policy?
It might. I mean, the fact is President-elect Trump has a wide array of people or types of people in his foreign policy team. The interesting common denominator is none of them have experience actually making foreign policy. The two generals enacted foreign policy, but the military does not make policy. And you have someone who was on the Hill on the Intelligence Committee taking over the CIA, but he hasn't actually made foreign policy either. And, of course, Rex Tillerson, the new Secretary of State, will come in having spent his entire life at ExxonMobil. He started out as a production engineer. He's done important deals with foreign countries, dozens of foreign countries, Russia being at the top of the list. But that is clearly one of the credentials that impressed the president-elect. And so there are a lot of questions, even among some Republicans, about how that may sway or shape his the role and the policies he advises for President Trump, who notably has almost no foreign policy experience and will rely on this team probably disproportionately than any recent president.
Is there any indication of what people or leaders in the Middle East think of the soon-to-be change in U.S. leadership? Has ISIS commented on U.S. election results?
Well, the interesting thing is that many of the autocrats in the region were delighted when Trump won the election. And the first person to congratulate him in a telephone call was President Sisi in Egypt, who is a former field marshal and led a coup against a democratically elected government in Cairo and then won a presidential election a couple of years ago. The autocrats feel that this is a president who will endorse their regime, their autocratic style of ruling, because they create stability, that there will not be focus on human rights or democracy promotion or nation building, and that they will find an ally, a new ally in the White House. Even the Israelis are quite thrilled because Benjamin Netanyahu, who has been in office throughout his times, various times in office, always with Democrats, finds a strong ally. ISIS, in some ways, looks at Donald Trump as a more desirable of the two alternatives because they think they can bait the United States into a deeper penetration into the region, more troops, in a way that will deepen the conflict and help them recruit Muslims, foreign fighters, to join the cause, that it will polarize the region in ways that help the jihadis. So you get a wide array of reactions among a wide array of forces with very different ideologies and goals, but that all look at, many of them look favorably. The one country that's very nervous, of course, is Iran because of the nuclear deal and the threats by President-elect Trump to renegotiate it, rip it up, or try to corner the Iranians in lots of different ways.
I'm speaking with New Yorker staff writer Robin Wright, who's, and we'll get to the second article as well, about her article, After the Islamic State, Where Will Jihadis Take the War? Then she just recently has written, Having Tea with Hezbollah's Number Two, before we get to what he said about the election, you said that the ISIS leadership, whatever, has survived, and we'll get to that as well, thinks that Trump might help in polarizing the world a bit more and lead to new recruits. But haven't abuses at Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo Bay, and elsewhere affected our ability to advocate for victims' rights now? Some of the people who have attempted attacks in the U.S., like Faisal Shahzad, who tried to set off a car bomb in Times Square, said that it was in retaliation for U.S. drone strikes.
Absolutely. And I think one of the big questions we all have to be concerned about is how the new administration looks at the region, or looks at Muslims, through the prism of the clash of civilizations. And there has been talk by some of the appointed foreign policy team against Muslims, tweets about Muslims not being, or Islam not being, a rational religion. And that, of course, alienates whether it's Muslims in the region, and particularly our own Muslim population. And that's a real tragedy. We don't want to be in the same position that, for example, a country like France is, where a lot of the Muslim immigrants dating back to French colonial rule in the Middle East and North Africa feel marginalized. They are second and third generation French citizens. Their parents or grandparents came a long time ago, but they have never been incorporated, and they feel that the French government, the French society, has betrayed them, and so they have turned. Now, these are in tiny numbers, but they are disproportionately impactful because of the acts they're willing to take. And that's the real danger here, I think, that there has been an attempt, whether it's by the Obama or even the Bush administration, when President Bush got out and said Islam is not our enemy. There have been attempts to try to avoid that appearance of being the United States at war with Islam. And so the bottom line answer to your question is, yes, we have engaged in acts, whether it's Abu Ghraib or Guantanamo Bay, that alienate. We are not as bad as the Europeans, but there is the danger that the kind of language that the new administration uses gets us into trouble and a deeper polarization than we have today.
Last May, a top ISIS propagandist, Abu Muhammad al-Adnani, said, "Whoever thinks that we fight to protect some land or some authority, or that victory is measured thereby, has strayed far from the truth." Was he trying to save face, or did he have a point?
Both, I think. This was at a time that ISIS was beginning to lose territory, and there was an attempt, instead of the bravado of we're winning and we're growing and we're going to conquer the world, there was an attempt to say, well, it doesn't matter whether we have territory. We can still be as powerful even if we're forced into the desert as we once were before. Remember, we've seen this scenario when the United States deployed 20,000 troops in what was known as the Surge in 2006 in Iraq. The United States beat back an al-Qaeda franchise. But what happened was they went underground and they began attacks as an insurgency against Iraqis and the military. They went through prison breaks to mobilize and free their supporters. They engaged in a number of different activities. They regrouped in the desert, and then they came back to the world's surprise as ISIS and conquered a country that was the size of Indiana in both Iraq and Syria. Now, today they're losing territory, and they're saying, well, we can do this again, even if we have to retreat to the desert. And, of course, Adnani was finally found by the United States intelligence services, and he was killed in a U.S. airstrike in late August.
And it's been U.S. policy to go after the ISIS leadership. How much of the original ISIS leadership remains?
Well, it's interesting. The United States issued a statement today saying they hit three more of them who were living in Syria, people who had been involved in those attacks earlier in Europe. So the United States is continuing to go after them. The emir, the caliph of the Islamic State, Baghdadi, is still alive. He is in hiding. But many of the senior leadership has been killed, And so that has been important in not only killing off the troops, but killing off the people who are hardcore, who are trained, who are mobilizing and coming up with game plans politically, running the show and running the war. And so there's been progress made on that. I think the more dangerous thing that there's not a lot of attention is that as ISIS has been diminished, the al-Qaeda franchise, which is operating in an entirely different part of Syria, has begun to re-exert its claim to primacy of the world of jihadism, and that it's playing off the extremism of ISIS by trying to appear as a more moderate group because it's working alongside other Syrian rebels. It started social services in Idlib province in Syria. It started its own court system, and it's talked about, we want a caliphate, but we want to educate Muslims first. And so that's, and it broke away actually from ISIS and pledged allegiance to al-Qaeda. And that's a very worrisome trend. So when we look at what happens after the Islamic State, it's not just what happens to ISIS and their fighters, it's what happens to the jihadi world generally.
In an earlier article, you quoted journalist Hassan Hassan, who said that with the death of Adnani, the transition to the second and third tiers of the group is well underway, and this could affect the direction of the organization and how it operates. Should we assume that with so many of the original leaders gone, the Islamic State's behavior could become more erratic or violent, perhaps even split into various factions?
Absolutely, and there's the danger increasingly that they focus on the outside world. We may be nostalgic at some point about having the ISIS fighters contained basically in one space. They've called in their publications over the last 2 months for fighters and sympathizers around the world to engage in particularly knife fights and driving vehicles into public space. It led the United States, in fact, to issue a warning shortly before Thanksgiving to Americans in Europe and do an increase in security around the Macy's Thanksgiving Day parade because the ISIS publications even mentioned the Macy's parade as the kind of place where you go, you find people out in public spaces in large numbers. And so there's the danger that we see ISIS change from a proto-state or a pseudo-state into a traditional terrorist group and insurgency that will attack in Iraq and Syria, but will also increase its attacks, its plots in the West, particularly in Europe. And as they hope, they will find sympathizers in the United States to do their work for them.
Robin, we've run out of time, and there are so many other things I wanted to talk to you about, the role of Saudi Arabia in all of this, the impact of Sykes-Picot, which created many of the problems that we are discussing, your recent meeting with the number two Hezbollah leader. Perhaps we can continue this sometime soon.
I love that. I always love doing your show, Leonard. Thanks for having me.
And thank you so much for being on our show again. Robin Wright, her article, After the Islamic State, Where Will Jihadis Take the War, is in the New Yorker, but you can also find a link to it on our show page at wnyc.org/lopate. What do you do after you've won an Oscar for a film that you've directed, produced, and starred in? Well, if you're Ben Affleck, you up the ante. For his latest, Live by Night, he not only did all of the above, but also wrote the screenplay. It's based on Dennis Lehane's award-winning novel of the same name, and in it he plays Joe Coughlin, a World War I veteran who gets caught up in a life that takes him places he'd rather not go. The all-star cast includes Zoe Saldana, Brendan Gleeson, Chris Cooper, Sienna Miller, and Elle Fanning. It opens in a limited run on this Friday, and then wide on January 15th, I guess the limited run, because you want to be considered for an Oscar? Is that how it works, Ben?
Your lips to God's ears. The strategy actually is has more to do with sort of this kind of movie needing to sort of build up support, build up momentum, rather than just going out all blast the first weekend and having everything hinge on your Friday afternoon matinees in New York City. You have time to cultivate an audience and spread word of mouth. And, it's the kind of thing where you want people to have heard about the movie and hopefully have heard it's good.
This is your second film based on one of Dennis Lehane's books, following Gone Baby Gone. What is it about his works that you connect with? Is it the fact that you're both Boston natives? Does that play a part?
Well, you know, I'm not the first person to discover Dennis Lehane, Clint Eastwood.
He's been a guest on our show.
Oh, has he really? Yeah. There you go. And Clint Eastwood and Martin Scorsese have both adapted his books into movies, and this is the second one that I've done. And I guess, you know, I'd have to say, obviously, I'm a fan of his writing, but he writes great characters and great dialogue, and he writes in a very cinematic, visual way. It felt like the adaptation for this felt like he kind of jumped onto the screen off the page because there was so much rich material in the book.
You co-wrote Gone Baby Gone with Dennis Lehane. What made you want to go solo on this one?
This was just a kind of function of I read the book in its galley's form, and I was in the middle of watching a lot of classic Hollywood movies, and this felt to me like the perfect opportunity to pay homage to the great, not just the Warner Brothers gangster movies of the 30s and 40s, but also the great epic sweeping period stories in the 1970s, and that was what I was interested in doing, and this book just really fit the bill as soon as I read it, and I felt like, okay, I know what to do with this.
Your character, Joe Coughlin, is the son of a high-ranking Boston cop played by Brendan Gleeson. After the war, he gets caught up in a life of crime, but he says early on to a mobster, "I don't want to be a gangster." Why doesn't he consider himself a gangster, even though he actually is one?
Well, you know, he's trying to walk a fine line with the morality of having his own code and his own morality, and not, he's been very disillusioned by the experience in the war and taking orders that he thought, you know, march men to their death and they were senseless, and so he's decided he's not going to take orders from anyone anymore, which means he's in charge of his own destiny, but as being that he is in the underground and a criminal, that puts him in a tough spot in terms of moral decisions.
We learn a lot of that through a voiceover. Does the novel have a first-person narrative?
Yeah, the novel's got a... yes, I think so. It's about... I thought the voiceover was... a device that I don't, you know, people complain about oftentimes, but I found that, you know, it's really helpful, particularly in this genre, to hear the narrator's voice, and, you know, and there's room for that because of the history of films like that.
It also helps us through a rather complicated plot.
There's that too.
Did you have to go through a lot of revisions to get this?
Yeah, I did a lot of writing. I worked one of the producers, Jennifer Todd, I worked really closely with, and she probably should have a co-writing credit on it. She's read so many drafts and so many outlines and breakdowns. And, you know, there was a kind of complex, long division to distilling this long novel into one two-hour movie. But, you know, ultimately I just had to pick what I thought was the best stuff.
How did the process compare with the others that you've written, like Good Will Hunting, in that case with Matt Damon, and The Town? That was 6 years ago, Jeremy Renner and you?
Yeah. It compares. Every movie's different, and it's all defined by its own story. But, you know, Good Will Hunting was something that we came up with ourselves. So we had this genesis of that idea, and as a consequence, had more of a sense of freedom to play with it and make changes. You know, when you're adapting a book, you always have in the back of your mind the responsibility that you have to the author and to the book to maintain the integrity of what they did.
But Lehane said he watched his book transmogrify in your hands and that it was a special thing. What do you think he meant by transmogrify?
I don't know. If I were as literate as Dennis, I would know what that word meant. But, you know, he's been very supportive, and he's been very complimentary, and he's got a philosophy about his books, I think, that is probably very healthy for him, which is that he writes the book, and once he's done with that, if he sells the rights to someone who makes the movie, then they make the movie, and he's accountable for the book on the shelf and let the filmmakers do the rest.
I was thinking, you mentioned earlier, the classic movies of the 30s, Scarface and the like, but one of the differences here is that the three women are all very strong characters.
Yeah, that's what drew me to this story as well, is that they're strong, complicated female characters in the movie, and a bunch of them, which is, you know, unusual in Hollywood. And you know, they represent different things, you know, thematically. I think the first, the Emma Gould character, who's played by Sienna Miller, kind of is emblematic of that kind of crazy, mad, first love, sort of toxic, you know, they're bad, good and bad for each other. They have a kind of Bonnie and Clyde thing. And then the Zoe Saldana character and my character's relationship with her later is more representative of a kind of mature, real, self-sacrificing love.
Although that also brings in all sorts of things like Southern racial politics, because a lot of, although it begins in Boston, much of it takes place in Florida.
Yeah.
And the KKK, yeah, the KKK plays a role in this story.
Yeah. It's, you know, race and politics and immigration were all themes of the book, and I didn't think would be so relevant as they are, you know, because of the current political climate. All of a sudden, some of these issues that we brought up, I feel, I'm almost too on the nose, instead of being, you know, initially my concern would be too distant.
My guest is Ben Affleck, who directed, produced, wrote, and stars in Live by Night, which opens locally on Christmas Day, and then will open wider in January. All of the performances are just terrific. Is casting a big part of the battle?
Yeah, you know, John Ford said 90% of directing is casting, and I think he was on to something. You know, you can't, once you've made the decision to cast somebody, you know, you can only change so much, really. You know, you can move the needle about 10%, but the die is largely cast at that point, and so to speak, and that's really where you make, you know, your big bold choices as a director, is who you entrust with these parts.
And so the character's right hand man, Dion Bartolo, is played by Chris Messing, who Mindy Kaling fans will recognize from the Mindy Project.
This was a far cry from the Mindy Project.
Chris Messina, what did I say? Chris Messina. You had him in Argo?
Yeah, I worked with him in Argo, became friends with him, loved him as an actor and as a guy so much, I thought I really want to put him in my next movie. And there was this role for a kind of a tough guy, a heavy, you know, an enforcer, but also a best friend, someone that is very loyal to my character. And, you know, he was so self-conscious of not being physically big that he decided to put on weight. And then he ended up gaining 40 pounds for the part and, like, really did physically transmogrify or whatever.
Into a heavy.
Yeah, into a heavy, literally.
And then there's the casting of Brendan Gleeson, who plays your father, and Chris Cooper, who plays the Tampa chief of police. With such a big cast and so many complicated locations, was it hard to direct then star in it yourself?
Yeah, you're always taking a little bit of a bandwidth that you would like to use for headspace as a director away when you have to also be acting at something and thinking about how you're going to perform it. By the same token, a lot of the research that you do as a director is what you really should do as an actor anyway. So you're very thoroughly prepared and deeply enmeshed in the story in a very healthy way. But
and coming up with backstories?
Yeah, you come up with backstories. You need to be able to answer anybody's question, basically. You need to be the expert on the movie. And that means a lot of preparation. And, you know, what it is for me as an actor, it just means that I have to sort of set that part of my mind aside if we're doing my coverage of a scene and focus on the performance and then sort of gather my wits about me after that and think about the whole broader movie.
And then think about how the camera moves and all of those things. And you chose to shoot it digitally?
We shot with the camera called the Alexa 65, which means it's like the digital equivalent of 65 millimeter, essentially, in terms of visual information. It's an extraordinary camera. I would never have shot on digital at all, except that my cinematographer, this guy named Bob Richardson, who's just a genius, you know, really encouraged me to look at this particular format. And we shot a lot of tests, and we shot film, and we shot this camera. And what we were able to do, it first of all didn't look like video. And ironically, we were able to make it feel and look more like classic film than the film prints that we shot.
It also allowed you to do all sorts of effects, like having car chases with a lot of machine gun fire.
Yeah.
The choreographing of that must have been extraordinary.
Yeah. The action stuff was a lot of fun, but it's a lot more like math. You know, you have to have every frame, and you storyboard it, and you figure out where it's going to be and how each one interconnects, and then you build a previs, and then through that you expand and get all your, you know, shots piece by piece by piece. It's very piecemeal.
And then there's the matter of casting the vintage cars. Are there still a lot of those old cars around? Although we don't see Model A's in this as you normally see in movies that are set in that time period.
Yeah, I try to find some more unusual cars and they're around. There's guys who collect them and women who they are very fastidious about taking care of them, and they want you to be very careful.
But they look like they're going to flip over.
Well, what we did with some of them is because the original cars had 18 horsepower. So a car chase with two cars at 18 horsepower would have looked like one of those terrible sort of Keystone Cops, silent movie gags. So we had to we rebuilt the cars for the chase and put more contemporary engines, not necessarily the suspensions and the brakes, but the engines got bigger, and so the chase feels more contemporary.
Let's talk just a little bit about your own career. How old were you when you starred in the PBS educational series, The Voyage of the
Mimi?
Yes.
The pilot we did, I was 8. And then we did the first season, I was 10 years old. And the next season, I was 13.
And you already had decided to change your name to Ben Affleck. The original name, I guess, doesn't sound movie starish. Benjamin, is it Giaz Affleck Bolt?
Oh, that's my full Benjamin Geza Affleck. Geza is a Hungarian name. I was named after a concentration camp survivor who was a friend of my parents, and they met before I was born. He was a supposedly very extraordinary guy. And now every time I meet someone from Hungary, they always say, "Like, is your name Geza? Really, it's Geza." They wonder if I'm Hungarian, but I don't have that distinction, unfortunately. But I do bear the name of somebody really special. Anyway, my parents hyphenated their last names, Affleck Bolt. My father's last name was Affleck. My mother was Bolt. So they gave both my brother and I hyphenated last names, but then immediately stopped using them. So both of us just grew up as Ben and Casey Affleck.
And your brother is really hot right now. What an amazing performance in Manchester by the Sea.
Yeah, I'm so happy with. I mean, that movie is amazing, and what he did in it, and the performance that he turned in, it's pretty extraordinary, and it's really fun to see so many people recognizing his talent and being admiring of it, and I'm thrilled.
Is it true that one of your creative writing professors in college ridiculed an early draft of Good Will Hunting?
No. What's true is that they wouldn't allow. I had a creative writing professor, and they said, "Well, we just want 20 pages of anything." And so I turned in 20 pages of Good Will Hunting, and they said, "No, screenplay is not an acceptable literary form." So then I was forced to write 20 pages, on the fly, and that was that. So the professor ridiculed rather thoroughly. So it was a negative experience trying to combine my screenwriting with my college years.
I think that would change today.
I think so. I think people respect the literary format of a screenplay much more, yeah.
And how did you wind up hooking up with Matt Damon? Weren't you in different grades?
Yeah, Matt's quite a bit older than I am. he's born in 1970, if you can imagine such a thing. And but I was born in 72, so being much younger. And we weren't in the same grade, but I met him just because we lived down the street from me, and then we lived in the same neighborhood and, played in the same park and hung out with the same group of kids and played in the same little league and all that stuff.
Well, now that you have directed, produced, written, and starred in a film, what's next? Editing, cinematography?
Well, it makes it sound like a one man band, but the truth couldn't be further from that. Filmmaking is such a collaborative medium. You really rely on the other people you're working with, and I leaned very heavily on this extraordinary group of people I had for this movie. It's the best crew I ever had and the best cast. Bob Richardson, as I said, who was the photographer, was a brilliant guy. Jackie West, who did the costumes, did an unbelievable job. Jess Gonscher, who's worked with the Coen brothers, did the production design. And those were the elements that I really cared about. I wanted the audience to feel swept away, to have that kind of magical feeling that you used to have when you watch big, sweeping epics.
And one of the problems with films that are set in an earlier time is they can look like museum pieces. You had, I'm sure you worked very hard to prevent that from happening.
Yeah, you have to find it. It has to be appropriately period, but then also appropriately real, you know. And there's sometimes designers go back and are too meticulous and don't allow for the chaos of life to have happened. And you know, you have if you do a movie in 1929, you don't just have 1929 cars. You have some people still doing horse and carriage. You have cars from 1921. You know, you have all sorts of influences.
Your mother wanted you to be a teacher. How long before she became reconciled to your being an actor?
She's almost there.
Ben Affleck directed, produced, wrote, and stars in Live by Night, which opens limited on the 15th and then wide on January 15th. And it has been my great pleasure to have you on our show today.
Thank you so much. I'm a fan.
I believe Eugene O'Neill was the greatest American playwright. He was a monumental figure in theater whose epic plays often explored the darker themes of family life in American society. The autobiographical connections between his life and his work have long fascinated theatergoers and authors Arthur and Barbara Gelb, who have been researching and writing about O'Neill for over 50 years. Their latest book, the third in a series, is called By Woman Possessed, and it looks at the playwright in the context of the women he loved, hated, and wrote about. It's published by G.P. Putnam Sons, and I'm very pleased that it brings Barbara Gelb back to our show. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And we should point out that your husband died on May 20th, 2014. How far along was the writing of this book at that time?
It was practically finished. We had, we were finished our last draft, except for maybe one or two paragraphs at the end. And thank God it was, because I don't know if I could have done anything more than I did. If it weren't almost finished, I couldn't have done all the technical work afterwards by myself.
Well, I'm sure you knew pretty much everything that needed to be in the book. The two of you began working on the story of Eugene O'Neill's life over a half century ago. Did you imagine that kind of commitment when you began writing the first book in 1962?
No way. We had no idea that he was going to take over our lives.
How long had you been working on this volume?
We had been working almost 10 years on it.
Going back to the beginning of the story, did the very successful revival of Iceman Cometh in the 1950s lead to a renewed interest in his work?
Did lead to a new...
Because he'd gone into decline, even though he had been a towering figure in the theater in the 20s and 30s, the first American playwright to win a Nobel Prize. What happened?
That's correct. What happened was that he wrote a play that got very bad reviews called Days Without End. And he thought it was a wonderful play at that point. And he was disgusted with the critics. And he said, I'm not going to do anything on Broadway anymore. And, you know, for at least the next few years, I'm just going to write and put it away and see what happens in the theater, because the theater is not for me anymore.
Was Days Without End as bad as the critics thought?
Yes, it really was. Maybe not quite as bad as the critics thought, but he himself came to realize that it was not a good play, because he was struggling at that point to decide whether to go back to Catholicism. And he had, of course, dropped it. He had been brought up as a devout Catholic. And when his mother became a drug addict, and he prayed and prayed for her not to be, and God didn't listen to him, then he decided he was not going to be a churchgoer anymore.
Didn't he say about the critics, I love every bone in their head?
He did indeed. That's
one
of my favorite quotations.
Actually, one of the things that people probably only realize when they're seeing one of the plays is just how witty he could be.
Oh, I'm glad.
You have Long Day's Journey into Night, this very powerful drama, and yet there are lots of laughs sprinkled through it.
I'm so glad you noticed that. Most people think he's just a very gloomy person and that he wrote nothing but deep, deep tragedy, but you're absolutely right. Long Day's Journey has a lot of funny things in it. even A Moon for the Misbegotten, which may be his most deeply tragic play, has two very funny scenes in it.
And then he did write a comedy, Our Wilderness.
He did.
Is it funny?
Moderately funny. It's more sentimental and sort of nostalgic than funny.
So under what circumstances did Iceman come? Why was it revived?
It was revived because a young director named Jose Quintero, who was a great O'Neill fan and who happened to have been born on his birthday, although he was a Panamanian and much younger than O'Neill, of course, he became very interested in reading O'Neill's plays, and he established this off-Broadway theater called Circle in the Square, and he began by reviving plays that he thought had not gotten their due the first time, including some Tennessee Williams plays, and he thought that The Iceman Cometh was a brilliant, wonderful play that had not been well received when it was first done.
Well, maybe you just needed better directors like Quintero. And then later, Sidney Lumet did a TV version of it that's quite brilliant.
Yes, that it is. But I think Lumet probably couldn't have done that if he hadn't seen Quintero's version.
So Long Day's Journey Into Night was then produced because people were suddenly interested in O'Neill again?
It seems that. Quintero had to get permission from O'Neill's widow, Carlotta Monterey.
Because O'Neill had written into his will that it couldn't be produced for 25 years after he died.
Well, first after Quintero did The Iceman Cometh, and it was a tremendous success off-Broadway. And Quintero then went to Carlotta and said he would like to produce Long Day's Journey, which every producer in New York wanted to do, of course.
Had they seen the play, or they just suspected that it was good?
It had been published. Uh-huh. But how many people buy a published play? You know, not too many. And Carlotta, who just turned down everybody, and it's true that O'Neill had said that it could not be produced, but when Carlotta wanted to believe something different, she just did. And she said yes to Quintero, and he was allowed to produce it.
I saw it as a high school student, was overwhelmed. But it had one of the most amazing casts you could ever put together for a Broadway show.
It did, up to a point.
Well, Frederick March and Florence Eldridge and Jason Robarts.
Right.
Not bad.
Yeah. All except Florence Eldridge, who was not really the ideal person.
I thought her performance was brilliant. For years, I thought nobody lived up to it until I saw Jessica Lange recently.
Right. Well, but that was a completely different interpretation, Jessica Lange, from Eldridge.
Much of O'Neill's writing dealt with dark subjects, heroin addiction, infidelity, alcoholism, despair. Why do you think so many ordinary theatergoers identified with his characters?
Because basically what it all went down to was the family problem. And I think most families, they don't have as dire problems as O'Neill had. But they do have conflicts, and I think that they see that in Long Day's Journey.
When you saw it in that production, did you wonder at the time whether portions of Long Day's Journey or The Iceman Cometh were autobiographical?
Not The Iceman Cometh so much, but certainly Long Day's Journey, because O'Neill was very reclusive and he hardly ever gave interviews, but we did know a few things about him, and we did know that his father was an actor. And we did not know that his mother had been a morphine addict. But, of course, our curiosity was very much piqued, Arthur's and mine. And that's one of the reasons we decided we wanted to write the book, because we wanted to know what the truth was of how much of Long Day's Journey was actually autobiographical.
You and Arthur were both very young at the time that you were given the assignment to write the biography. Wasn't Brooks Atkinson the first choice?
Yes, he was. I have to.
What happened? How did you and Arthur get the job?
Arthur was sort of Brooks's protege on the Times. Brooks was training him to be a theater critic. And he went to the theater an awful lot, and we were both big theater goers. And we both were big fans of O'Neill. And Brooks felt that he could not take time off to write the biography. And he said, "Would you consider my young colleague, Arthur Gelb, who was very knowledgeable about the theater and whose wife grew up with a theater family and they can't take, he's not allowed to take time off from the time, so he will need someone to help him do the research. And they hemmed and hawed for a while, but finally they said yes. And Brooks also said, I will help them get to Carlotta Monterey, his widow, who was very difficult to talk to.
I heard that you actually met O'Neill once.
I did meet him once.
What were the circumstances?
My stepfather was a playwright, S.N. Berman, and he had a play.
A pretty good playwright, in fact.
He was. He was not a tragedian. He was a comedian. Anyway, he knew O'Neill. He had met him in California, and O'Neill had shown him his Nobel Prize, and they had hit it off very well. Anyway, O'Neill happened to be having rehearsals for one of his plays, and my stepfather had a rehearsal for one of his at the same time on Broadway. And my stepfather asked me whether I would like to come to a rehearsal when O'Neill was going to be there, which, of course, I was thrilled to do. And I met him to the degree that I shook hands with him and that, you know, said that I was a great fan of his.
Wasn't the advance for the first book so small that you had to get other money from family and other sources just to fund
the research?
Yes,
it's true. They did not give us what they would have given Atkinson, obviously.
They gave Atkinson a theater.
Well, that was later. That was not the people who wanted to write the biography.
What is makes O'Neill's plays special? It seems to me that the best plays were the later ones, but... The Emperor Jones was a groundbreaking play.
Yes, well, it was groundbreaking, which is why it was interesting, because nobody had ever done anything like that before. And also, he was the first important theater person who would cast a black person in a leading role in a Broadway play.
It would have been done in blackface otherwise?
Yes, exactly. Isn't that lovely?
So that was his decision?
That was O'Neill's decision completely, yes.
Was that Paul Robeson?
It was Paul Robeson who took over the role. It was a different actor whom you probably never heard of at the beginning. But that actor was brilliant in the role, probably maybe even better than Robeson. But he tended to be a drunkard. And O'Neill did not think he was doing justice to the play after a certain length of time, and he was replaced.
And then he cast a black actor opposite a white woman in All God's Children.
That's true, too, yes.
So he
But was... that was a quieter play, and it was not a Broadway production. It was done by the Provincetown Players, which were supposedly a private club and not subject to the laws of the theater.
I'm speaking with Barbara Gelb, who, with her late husband Arthur, has written a number of books about Eugene O'Neill. The one we're discussing is by Women Possessed, A Life of Eugene O'Neill. It is published by Putnam, and we will continue our conversation after this. We are back with Barbara Gelb, who is co-author with her late husband, Arthur Gelb, of the third volume in a series of biographies of Eugene O'Neill. This one, By Women Possessed, A Life of Eugene O'Neill, published by Putnam. Hadn't you covered most of the life in the first two? What did you find new for this book?
What we found new, basically, was Carlotta's diaries, which she had deposited at Yale University and asked not to be released to anyone, researchers or anybody. Until after her death.
And how extensive were her diaries?
They were huge. She wrote a diary for nearly every year that she was with O'Neill, starting from the time they eloped in 1928. And she
was what, his third wife?
She was his third wife, yes. His first wife was a kind of a forced marriage. He got a 20-year-old girl pregnant when he himself was only 20. And they had a child, but... They never lived together. In fact, he did not see the child, Eugene Jr., until the boy was 11 years old. And his second wife was Agnes Bolton, who he married because he was in love with, really. And they were both bohemians together in those days. they lived a lot in Provincetown, which was a bohemian community.
And he played a major role in the development of the Provincetown Playhouse.
Yes, he did. He was their prize playwright. They were all amateurs at that time, but they wanted to bring something like the old Greek theater to Broadway, which was quite an undertaking. And they could never have done it without O'Neill, although they had some other talented people. But the O'Neill marriage to Agnes produced two children whom O'Neill didn't really want. And after about 10 years, they divorced. But O'Neill, meanwhile, had fallen in love with this beautiful actress, Carlotta Monterey, who was played in one of his plays, the Hairy Ape. And they went off together. And she was his third wife once Agnes agreed to give him a divorce.
You had interviewed her extensively, but the diaries gave you all sorts of material that she hadn't talked about?
Yes, exactly. But it also expanded on a lot of things she had talked about. And she was not terribly conscientious about telling the truth. She was an actress, and she was also very imaginative. And she tended to make things up to make her look interesting and glamorous. But we saw through a lot of that because, we knew what kind of a person she was.
And she preferred talking to Arthur than to you.
Well, some of the reviewers got that a little wrong. She often preferred talking to him, but she talked to me a great deal also. She sometimes liked to be interviewed by each of us separately. I think maybe the fact that we interviewed her together got her a little nervous at times.
You mentioned that the Provincetown Playhouse wanted to come up with some kind of an American equivalent of Greek theater. Do you think that O'Neill saw his tragic characters as coming out of the kinds of themes that
yes,
Greek theater?
Definitely.
An American Euripides or
yes,
Sophocles?
Well, Mourning Becomes Electra is essentially a Greek tragedy transposed to America during the Civil War era. But he also got his themes from the Bible, and he also got a lot of his inspiration from Shakespeare.
And an awful lot from his own life, as you point out.
From his own life, yes.
He had a long cycle about the Irish as well.
Yes, that's a great tragedy for the American theater that he was never able to finish that. It was really a history of the American psyche. And he was predicting the fact that America was getting more and more greedy and losing its soul. And it was not the country that it started out to be.
So did you see notes and segments from
his plans? He left many, many notes and segments. And they're very interesting, fascinating. They tell you the whole story. But he did complete one play, and that was A Touch of the Poet. That was part of an 11-play cycle. But it's a very good, interesting play.
And it's been revived well in recent years.
It has not ever been revived beautifully.
Oh, I saw a rather nice revival of some years back. Well, maybe we disagree, but...
It's a very interesting play, but I think it hasn't had its real iconic performance yet.
You begin this book in 1928 at the opening night of Strange Interlude.
Yes, that was a fascinating play.
Well, that play almost sounds like it was written... because he was in psychotherapy. But was he reading Freud?
He read Freud. He read Jung. He read everything. And he was not ever in real therapy, but he had some psychiatric help from some doctors. Doctors adored him, and they could wait to get into his life. But there was some psychiatric references in the Strange Interlude. But when he was accused of being a Freudian, he said, any good writer knows as much as Freud about psychoanalysis.
Why wasn't he at the opening?
He never went to the openings of any of his plays. He was very nervous. He couldn't stand the idea that the actors weren't going to be doing exactly what he wanted them to do. And it's strange that he insisted on being a playwright because he didn't really like actors at all. He felt they never gave him what he had written.
Some playwrights love actors because they give them things that they didn't even realize were in their plays.
Well, O'Neill was not one of those people.
How long was the running time of Strange Interlude?
It was about 4 hours with a dinner intermission.
And that was okay?
It was okay.
With audiences at that time?
Yes, it was okay with audiences at that time. Way before that, when O'Neill's father was acting, audiences sat through plays that lasted 5 hours.
Was that play kind of autobiographical as well?
Strange Interlude was very autobiographical. It was about all the women that he knew, including his mother. And he was mainly about woman as such.
And so many of the plays were about, well, not all of them, but so many about women. In the case of A Long Day's Journey, even though only one woman is in that play, or really two women, but only one important woman in that play, she kind of dominates the play.
Yes, she does.
She's upstairs half the time, and yet she dominates the play.
Well, she does, because his mother, Ella O'Neill, who was Mary Tyrone in Long Day's Journey, dominated his life throughout his life and even after her death.
What about his drinking problems? He drank on and off. He fell off the wagon.
He was a binge drinker, and he said he never wrote a play while he was drunk, which I don't think is quite true. But he was supposedly sober after a certain point in his life. But it's not true. He kept drinking almost till the end of his life, on and off. There were constant relapses.
He and Carlotta decided to take a trip abroad. This is after his marriage broke up with Agnes.
Yes, but he was not yet married to Carlotta. They eloped, and they were waiting for Agnes to divorce him. But meanwhile, they were living together, and they took a trip to China.
Was he researching a play?
He had always wanted to go to the Orient. He had written a play about China to some extent, Marco Millions, which was about Marco Polo. He might have written a play about China, but he was not specifically researching anything. He was just going for his own pleasure and for Carlotta's.
And what happened to that marriage?
It was very, very passionate and loving, with on and off drinking episodes for about 10 years. And then he began getting more and more ill. He had always been subject to flu-like illnesses, and he had a tremor in his hands, which was a family thing that he inherited. But he was getting more and more, he was getting weaker and weaker and less able to function properly. And he, in 1943, after finishing Long Day's Journey, He could not really write anymore, because he could only write with a pencil and paper. He could not dictate. He could not use a typewriter. And so he gradually had to stop writing. And once he stopped writing, he didn't know what to do with himself, because he had all these ideas. And so he started living the drama, and he picked Carlotta to be his leading lady and victim. They started having terrible fights, and that's what happened to the marriage.
It ended the marriage.
Didn't end it, but...
There are so many plays mentioned in this book that we've never seen. Are any of them worth reviving?
The ones we've never seen, no, I don't think so. Hmm. But, you know, people do revive them.
And then there are those early plays, all those sea plays. Well, should we be seeing them again?
We could be seeing them. We also could be seeing the movie called Long Voyage Home, which is a conglomeration of those early sea plays.
Barbara Gelb, with her late husband Arthur Gelb, wrote By Women Possessed, A Life of Eugene O'Neill, published by Putnam. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to Leonard Lopate Weekend. We'll be back live on the radio on Monday at noon, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at Leonard Lopate or at facebook.com/LeonardLopateWNYC. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.